So happy to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at taxes with you today. How prepared are you for your tax filing? Oh, my goodness. I have a few things yet to collect. Some things have arrived in the mail, some haven't. And I'm interested to know if there are ways that I can save some money on my taxes. How about you? I stay listening because Mary Mellum is our guest. Tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She's been in the tax business for 30 years, and she and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And in addition to servicing 1,200 tax and accounting clients during the year, their business includes tax consulting for other tax professionals, as well as teaching tax seminars around the country. She joins us today from our Green Bay studios. Mary Mellum, great to have you back. Thanks for being with us. Let's see. Mary, are you there? Well, I tell you what. I'm sure. I'm going to try one more thing. Mary, are you there? Tell you what. I'm sure we're going to be able to figure this out. Yeah, I'm positive we'll be able to figure this out. In the meantime, if you would like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. You can post your questions or your comments there. And I know some of the things that I want to talk about with Mary have to do with health insurance. Health insurance, and Mary, are you there yet? No, not hearing her. Health insurance is kind of a big issue this year because we have to provide some proof of health insurance. And I kind of want to know what the latest is on that. And I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to do that as we visit with her, if we visit with her. And so we're gonna try that anyway. I also want to talk about kind of life changes, how that affects your taxes. You got births, you got adoptions, you got marriage, you got divorces. In general. What deductions are available to you if you have children, and how old are those children, or how old do they? What's the upper limit on having your children being able to count them as a deduction? So we're going to be taking. Want to find out about that, and there are some specifics as well out there for adoption credits. And I'm hoping that we're going to be able to talk with her about that. It's also possible that we'll be able to get her on by phone. And Judith's working on that right now. She's, you know, in situations like this, I'm supposed to remain calm and talk. And I think I do that. And there are a bunch of other people who are we're tearing their hair out and running around and trying to figure out what the heck is going on. So. And I've already had engineers in the studio to take a look, and they say, no, Larry, you are doing everything the way you're supposed to be doing it here on the board. So the phone can work as well. And so we're going to try and get her on by phone. Just to mention, as long as I have some things in front of me here, a garden talk tomorrow. We're going to talk with the author of The Market Gardener. It's a successful grower's handbook for small-scale organic farming, which I'm going to kind of be looking forward to that as well. And right now, Mary Mellum, I'm sure she's going to be with us pretty quickly here by phone. We'll get her on. And then we'll be able to talk with her for sure. Let's see. We will see if I can get her on now. Is she on? No, she's not on quite yet, but we'll have her on in a minute. So a couple of other things I want to look at with her, how to reduce tax liabilities, what are some of the common ones that we miss? I really try hard not to do that. And I work with a tax professional, to be perfectly honest. So I get a lot of help that way. And I've also used TurboTax, which I found to be pretty useful as well, especially when it came to deductions. Something like a TurboTax, if you're not using a tax preparer, it has amounts. So if you have donated coats, for example, it'll give a practical or what a reasonable amount of money should be for that kind of product. So anyway, that's something you get from TurboTax, but you're going to get a whole lot more, I think, from a tax professional like Mary Mellum. And let's see if we got her on here. Mary, are you there?
I'm here, Larry.
Oh, hey, and you know what? You sound really good, too.
Oh, good. That's wonderful.
Oh, I'm really glad to have you back. It's and this is your busy time of the year.
Well, it certainly is. It's starting up.
Most of us are probably seeing interest income statements, the W-2s, and maybe the 1099s coming in the mail. What are the deadlines to get that documentation to us? And what should we do if the date passes?
Well, the initial documentation for most information returns, including W-2s, is January 31st. However, there is an extension that some businesses can get, and generally the extension is the broker's. And so many of your 1099 INTs and dividends through brokerage companies and your 1099 Bs for sale of property do not come out until February 15th. So people that have investments typically file a little later than those that are just doing their wages and maybe a little bit of interest.
Yeah. As we talked about last month, one of the big new issues to be aware of this year is that people need to have proof of health insurance. What's the latest on that?
This year is, I have to say, the mandate started for 2014. The individual mandate. The employer mandate, which is another part of the Affordable Care Act, is pushed off for a year. But individuals have to have health insurance for the entire year, or there's a penalty to pay. There are a number of exceptions that exist, but it takes a little bit of maybe paperwork to do those. At this point, the IRS has put in place three different forms. They're called 1095A, B, and C. And those forms are supposed to be proof of insurance. However, the only one that is available for 2014 is the 1095A. And that 1095A is a piece of paper that will come to anyone who has purchased their insurance through the marketplace.
Okay.
And that is a vital piece of paper that you have to have, because if you purchased it, it not only proves that you have health insurance and what time frame, but it also, if you were fortunate enough to get the credit or get a help paying your insurance, that document will tell the important information that you need in order to fill out the credit. And anyone who did shop at the marketplace and get help paying for their health insurance has to file a tax return to reconcile that through the premium assistance credit.
Oh, so even if you might not even be eligible to pay any income taxes, you'd still have to file that?
If you do not have to file a tax return, you do not have to prove proof of insurance. But if you have gotten help to pay through the marketplace, you must file a tax return to reconcile it.
And if you don't have the insurance or the proof, you're going to get fined?
Yes. There is a shared responsibility penalty that is assessed on people. The penalty is the greater of $95 per individual or 1% of the household income. And basically, looking at a household, you're looking at your tax return, and you're looking at the people who are shown on the tax return, mom, dad, and the children, or mom and the children, whatever appears on the front of the tax return, those are all the people that that taxpayer is responsible for in terms of making sure that they have insurance, or they will be held responsible for the penalty of not having insurance.
Okay. And if you're going to a tax preparer, let's say somebody who works for the state, for example, and maybe on some state health program, do you need to get something from the state health program or from your...
This year, since the IRS doesn't have these forms being required, the 1099 B and C, which are also indications of health insurance, what many tax professionals are doing are looking for some indication that you have health insurance, or you may see them asking you to sign a statement verifying that you have health insurance for that part of the year.
Okay.
What you might want to do as a person going to see a professional, if it is through your employer, having the final pay stub is an indication, because if you're paying it through payroll, either pre-tax or post-tax, it's probably an indication on your final pay stub.
Yeah, that makes good sense. We have one other thing I wanted to bring up before we go to the phones, and all our lines are busy here. The White House talked recently about phasing out that 529 college plan tax deduction, but took that off the table when a lot of people spoke against it. Maybe you could mention the advantages of saving for college with EdVest and other 529 college plans.
Sure. There are two programs that are called the 529 and the 530 plan. There is no tax deduction on the federal return for either plan. Those two plans allow you to put money into an account, and that money grows tax-free as long as it's used for education. The states, many of them, including Wisconsin, have taken it a step further, and the 529 plan is what we call the EdVest in Wisconsin.
Yes.
And on the Wisconsin tax return, you are allowed to take up to a $3,000 deduction against your Wisconsin income for the money that you put into the EdVest account.
So that can be a pretty good deal.
It's a wonderful deal. It is. They have opened up, made it more liberal this year than they did in the past. First of all, last year, for 2013, your contributions had to be in by December 31st of 2013. This year, they have expanded that to say that you have until April 15th, much like your IRAs, mm-hmm. to put the money in for the prior year. Wisconsin has created a new schedule on the tax return called the CS that you will put down the name of who holds the account and who is this account for. In other words, if a parent opens up an account for their child, the parent's the owner of the account, the child is the beneficiary of the account, and it's documented on that form. But more than that, grandparents oftentimes contribute for their grandchildren. In the past, grandparents had to set up the account, they being the owner and having the grandchild as the beneficiary. They have liberalized the plan in that a grandparent need not set up their own plan. If mom and dad, for instance, have a plan set up, they can contribute to mom and dad's plan and still take the deduction on their own tax return. Oh. And this CS form allows the reporting of that.
That's a very good liberalization. Outside of the 529 programs, let's say tuition, you're paying tuition for your student to attend, I don't know, grade school or middle school, high school, college. Is that tuition deductible?
First of all, the 530 plan I mentioned, the ability to put money away and grow tax-free, the 530 plan does allow you to put money away to be used for elementary and pre-college education. The 529 is strictly post-secondary. Wisconsin, federal does not have any deduction for pre-college. We have what's called the American Opportunity Credit and the Lifetime Learning Credit, which allows you to take a deduction or a credit for tuition that's paid for college or post-secondary education. However, Wisconsin has never had that credit but has a deduction for post-secondary. But this year, they started a new deduction for private school education. And again, it's on the Wisconsin return only. It is a subtraction. And for private school elementary education, you can take a deduction of up to $4,000 per student. And for secondary education, the deduction for attending a private school is $10,000, up to $10,000 per student.
Talking today with Mary Mellum, who's giving us some great advice here, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Been in the business a long time. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. And, of course, we're looking forward to your calls and questions. And we're going to go to those calls in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're getting some great tax preparation advice from Mary Mellum. And, Mary, we're going to take a call. Let's go to Marilyn in Milwaukee, who's been waiting a long time. Hi, Marilyn. Thanks for waiting.
That's okay. I've got a question on behalf of the 10 million or so people who do not have a computer and are told that they can't get instructions or publications. And how are we supposed to make out a return if we don't have the instructions? Other than, is this a new deal to force people to go to tax preparers or buy a computer?
You should be able to go to your public library for...
I did.
Yeah, and they didn't have forms?
They're waiting also. They have no forms yet. They hope to get some. They don't think they will get anything other than a 1040.
Well, that's really strange. Well, at least they have computers so that they can help you with at least.
But yes, they will print out an instruction booklet, 100 pages.
Yeah.
Like, come on. This
yeah.
is not the way to. How do we pay our taxes if we don't get the instructions?
Yeah. You're certainly raising a great point. You're not going to get much argument from me on that. Mary, Mary Mellum, what about it?
I think it's not any force to go to a professional. I think it comes down to economics. The government is trying to do more with less money, and that's one of the ways, because so many people have computers, that's one of the ways that they're cutting down on the spending that they're doing.
Hmm.
I would strongly recommend, if you are doing your own tax return and need a booklet, I would, first of all, try to find someone who has a computer that can print it for you. Or, you know, if it's that bad, call your congressman. You know, let them know what's going on, and maybe they can help.
Yeah, you know, if you call your representative, let's see, where are you, Milwaukee, you could call your you call your representative and say, hey, I need to get some of these materials. Will you send them to me? I bet the representative will probably mail you those materials.
Absolutely not. I've already called.
Ah, you're kidding.
No, I am not kidding.
I can't believe that.
This is the situation, and it's not just me. It's a lot of people. And then they say, well, if you're under a poverty level, you can get some help maybe. If they're not overwhelmed with, you know, tax.
Wow. Well, the IRS website says that you can order them by mail.
I have ordered them by mail. So has everyone in the library. The library reference people have sent in asking for
them. Well, I'm hoping that they will come through, and if they, I can. Obviously, I sense we can all hear your frustration on this, Marilyn. And I think hopefully in the next few weeks, you're going to get that information from the IRS. And if you don't, then you're probably going to have to go find somebody with a computer or go to the library and work with somebody at the library on the computer. I'm sorry it's come to that, but I don't know what, you know, I don't know what else we can tell Marilyn, Mary.
I think that the IRS has made an issue of electronically filing returns.
Yeah.
Not necessarily using a tax professional, but they want at least 80% of all returns electronically filed. That may have something to do with it, but certainly the access to the printed word, there's no excuse for not having that. And like I said before, budget cuts make a lot of difference. The IRS has cut back the people who answer the phones. They've told people that if you have questions as a consumer and you're trying to call the IRS, you can expect at least a half-hour wait, and they say that about 50% of the calls will go unanswered.
Oh.
So it is a budget thing, and I hope that yours will be solved quickly.
Yeah, thanks, Marilyn, for calling. I do as well. Hopefully next month, if we're talking about taxes, and hopefully by that time you will have gotten the information you need. I want to give Jim in Oconomowoc a chance to join us. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you both. My question is for my mother, 86 years old. About 5 years ago, she and my father moved into an assisted living facility. Now, they have had their taxes done by a professional for, I wouldn't even know how long, but for quite a while, I'm sure. And we found out last year that some of the rent, so to speak, for this assisted living, it can be deducted or credited or something like that. And they were paying pre-taxing, estimated taxes four times a year, I think it was, three or four times a year, quarterly. And when they took the document that this assisted living facility gave to them, their tax preparer said, oh, you'll get money back. And but the question I have is, how long has that been part of the law, and can they go back 4 years? They've lived in that place for five. Can they go back 4 years and refile, and instead of paying the estimated taxes, actually get that, at least recover that money, and then whatever else? And I will hang up and listen to your mm-hmm. phone call.
Okay, thanks, Jim, for calling. Mary, what about that?
Okay, first of all, let's talk about amending a tax return. You've got two issues. For federal tax purposes, you're allowed to amend for 3 years. The statute of limitations is open for 3 years. For the state of Wisconsin, it's open for 4 years. Now, there are two things when you're talking assisted living that come to my mind. First of all, the rent. Just if you're talking about assisted living, and we're not talking health issues here, and we're talking just rent, assisted living itself or rent is no deduction on the federal return. Of course, on Wisconsin, as long as the rent is paid to a taxable entity as opposed to a church or something like that, the rent that person is paying is a Wisconsin credit, a rent credit that can be gotten. But I think what he's really talking about here is a medical issue. And as for medical purposes, if you are in a facility for medical care, the cost of the medical care is deductible. The assisted living is a little bit kind of, I'd like to say, a gray area in a sense, because we know if you're in a nursing home, the cost of being in a nursing home, generally someone's in a nursing home because they have a health issue. And so the cost of the nursing home, which includes your medical care by the staff, your living there, and your meals, is a deductible medical expense. Assisted living can be a deductible medical expense if you are there because the doctor has said you have to be there, or at least to the extent that medical care is being given as a part of that assisted living. So the trick is to figure out, are you there because of a medical condition? And in the past few years, they've kind of, the idea of dementia or Alzheimer's may have someone living in an assisted living situation rather than living in a full-blown nursing home. And so some of those times, because of the doctor saying that they need to be there, they need to have someone to watch them, that can translate into a full medical deduction. But again, keep in mind that once it is a medical deduction, you need to itemize, because the medical deductions are on Schedule A. And for itemized deductions, currently we have a 10% floor, although for people who are over the age of 65 or 65 and over, that deduction, that floor, remains at 7.5% through 2016. So you need to have it, and I'm sure that that's where they're going with it, is the medical deduction.
Yeah, yep, yep.
And so it will be a Schedule A, and of course Wisconsin treats the medical a little bit different. Wisconsin does not have itemized deductions. However, we do have an itemized deduction credit that the medical flows through there on Wisconsin.
Elaine in Princeton, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about property taxes that are in arrearages. I have some property taxes that were due in 2013. I want to pay the taxes in full before the end of this month. I don't know if that makes a difference. But can I claim them on this year's taxes as being paid?
Do you mean 2014?
Also, yeah, if I can claim those, even though they were in arrearages.
Yeah.
And also, do I have to pay the penalties and the fines on my past on my taxes in arrearages at the time I pay the tax, or can I make payments on that?
Hmm. Mary?
Well, from an income tax standpoint, because I think you're mixing two questions here.
Yeah.
From an income tax standpoint, you are allowed a tax deduction. Again, it's a Schedule A itemized deduction for federal purposes. You're allowed a deduction for property taxes regardless of the year. You deduct them in the year you pay them. So if you are paying property taxes from 2 years ago or however long you can pay them and still own the property, you can deduct anything that is paid in the current year.
Okay.
Now, for Wisconsin, the property tax credit that you get, again, it's what you pay in the current year that qualifies for the property tax credit, not whether it's a 2013, a 14, a 12, whatever. The other part of your question dealing with the late fees and things like that, that has to do with the property tax assessment and the state of Wisconsin. That's not a tax issue that I can address. I would really talk to either your county treasurer, the person that is collecting the tax would be the better person to be able to answer the late payment issue.
Yeah, that's pretty good thing. And frankly, I know a couple of families that they'll pay their property taxes 2 years in 1 year, and then all their, you know, every expense they can in that same year, and then they'll take the standard deduction the next year.
And that is a good tax-saving technique for some people.
Yeah, it works for some people. Elaine, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Going back to this whole business about the rest homes or the homes for older folks and relating to medical issues and so forth, EJ in Fond du Lac wondered if you could deduct long-term care insurance premiums. Can you deduct that as a taxpayer or perhaps if you're a small business owner?
Long-term care insurance premiums are a deductible medical expense. There is a limitation for federal purposes based on your age. They have a scale starting with people who are under the age of 40. For 2014, if you're under the age of 40 and you're paying long-term care premiums, the maximum that you could deduct is $370. On the other end, if you're over the age of 70, that number of deductible for federal goes up to $4,660, and there's three categories between that. On Wisconsin, you are allowed to deduct the cost of the premium regardless of age, and it is a regular deduction against your Wisconsin income. It doesn't go through your itemized deductions as it does on the federal. Then the other part of his question about the business owner, if you are a small business and you pay long-term care insurance for yourself as a sole proprietor, it is a deduction that you can take on the front page of the tax return with the self-employed health insurance deduction.
Ah, there we go. Joel in Janesville has something for us, and I think, and for to help maybe help out Marilyn, who called earlier. Joel, hi.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yes, I was listening, and I was, you know, I heard Marilyn talking about her issues with getting instructions for her to file her income taxes this year. And I'm a graduate from the accounting program of the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. And I know we offered a program called VITA, V-I-T-A, which is a voluntary income tax program. So the people in the community could come to us, and the students under the tutelage of an academic advisor would file their income taxes for free as a real-world activity so they can get experience in the accounting field and experience with the income taxes. So I would suggest if Marilyn's listening, she should contact her local universities, maybe Marquette or UW-Milwaukee, to see if they offer the same program.
Yeah, it sounds like a great program. Thank you very much, Joel. I appreciate that. And we had a couple of other calls along that line. Mark wondered if ARP, AARP, would help the Milwaukee caller, if she's a member of, wondering if she's a member of ARP, if they have something. And caller K said that her senior center in Minocqua has volunteer tax preparers that come in. So she, Marilyn, might want to check with her senior center, her local senior center, and it's possible they do the same thing. They come in and help people for free. And so maybe she could check in on that as well. So those are all great suggestions. You know, it's always nice. Our listeners always want to be helpful, and it's great to hear from Joel and Mark and Kay and all the rest of the folks who called in with suggestions. Thank you. Courtney in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I know we were talking about education before, but I was just curious if there's any sort of deduction my parents can get for private college.
Okay. So you're going to a private college. They're covering tuition. And can they deduct that? What do you think, Mary?
There is a credit. Are you a dependent on their return, Courtney?
My parents are divorced, and they're splitting the tuition between them. I'm dependent under my father's name, but not my mother's.
Okay. The way the credit works is that the American Opportunity Credit or the Lifetime Learning Credit is available to the parent who claims the child.
Okay.
And all of the money, whether that parent pays the money or not, if that child is being claimed, the parent is deemed to have paid that money. And so if you're paying it or grandparents are paying the tuition, it is an opportunity for the parent who is claiming the child to take the education credit. And again, it's an education credit for basically tuition. In some cases, there are some fees that are allowed, but it is tuition, not room and board. There is a book part of it that was added to the American Opportunity Credit. But basically, you're looking at tuition, and if you're going to a private college, the tuition is probably going to offset without going to anything else. to take up the dollars that are there. The other thing that you do have to be careful of, or the parent that's taking it, or the person that's taking the credit, there is an income limitation. So high-end parents may not be able to deduct or to claim the education credit because their income is too high. And what we're looking at, there is a phase-out. If a parent makes over $160,000, that there is a possibility that the benefit of it phases out. And when they get to roughly $180,000 of income, they get no credit for it. So that's another thing that weighs into whether the credit is able to be claimed or not.
Interesting.
All righty.
Thanks, Courtney.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Appreciate your call.
One other thing that I just want to mention. The education credit is a very important credit. It's been around since 1996, I believe. It was under the Clinton administration that it came about. But the IRS is getting much fussier with it, and they have created a 1098-T that comes from the institution that generally will tell the amount of credit, the amount of tuition that has been charged. But one of the things that people don't go the step further that is good for them to do is to contact the institution that they're attending or did attend and get what we call a financial transcript. It's a listing of all of the payments that or all of the money that has been charged and all of the money that has been paid, because it is only the actual payment of tuition that counts towards the credit.
It's a very, very good point. So if you pay it all in one lump at the beginning of the year or at the beginning of the semester, you're probably fine. But if you're paying it monthly, certainly it would go
the
from 1 year
on
to
the
next.
The number on the 1098-T sometimes doesn't match the actual amount that has been paid during the year.
Yeah.
And that is why that financial transcript is an important document to ensure that you're claiming the correct amount.
Okay. And I know that Judith was saying where her daughter goes, the document is available for download from her student account online. So
that is correct. And so if mom and dad are claiming the child but don't have access to that account, they have to talk to the child and get that information from the child.
Get the child on the ball, in other words.
Right.
Bill in Viroqua. We'll get to you in just a minute. Just a reminder, we're visiting today and getting some great advice from Mary Mellum, tax professional. She's from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, Dave, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. We have a link to their, I believe we have a link on our Facebook page to their site. And doing a great job today. And certainly, if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. I actually have some open lines at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum, who operates with her husband, David, Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and was covering a lot of really useful information here. If you have a question, join in, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Bill in Viroqua, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a disabled guy of 62, and I haven't filed taxes for a few years because I didn't have any money. All my money is from Social Security and a very small pension. But I have, this year, I've taken a lot or some payments from my IRS and used it to, revise my living room and all that kind of stuff. And I want to at least see the thing and see if I owe any taxes. I've got this IRS tax form thing on my computer right now, and is that 1099 I want? In the back in the old days, They just mailed us a form, we filled it out, and we mailed it in. That was easy.
Yeah, Mary, can you?
I think what he's talking about is a 1099-R, which is the form that you get identifying how much you took out of your IRA.
All right, I've got all the things, what I've made in my money market savings account and my IRA and all that stuff. I've got all those forms, but I don't see. It used to be you just opened the booklet and saw how much you were. I'm sorry, I have trouble finding words. I had a stroke and I'm crippled and all that crap.
Do you have how much income you've made altogether?
Yes, it'd be around. It'd be something under $7,000 is what I've taken out of my IRA.
Okay. That $7,000 plus your half of your Social Security, again, depending on some or part of your Social Security may be taxable. But if you have only $7,000 that you took out and there's very little other income besides Social Security, there's a very good chance that you won't have to file because you have a standard deduction, which if you are single, the standard deduction for this year is $6,200, and you have a personal exemption of $3,950. And so that alone, without any additional information, is over $10,000.
Okay, that's very good. I mean,
that should help you. That should help. Well, yeah, you're probably not going to have to do it.
I think your first caller, this poor lady that can't get any forms or anything, that's kind of like you're supposed to make it easier to take your money rather than hard.
Yeah, you'd think you'd want to, if you were going to put money anywhere, you'd want to put it on the collection of tax money, but. It's kind of how it goes sometimes, Bill. Thank you so much for calling. I'm glad Mary was able to help you out here, and good luck. Helen and Big Bend, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Toward the end of the year, we got a postcard from a reputable university that we donate to saying that the House of Representatives passed America Gives More Act of 2014 and that we could make donations to charities up until our taxes are due, which could be April 15th of 15, and still take them on as a tax deduction in our 2014. I have not read anything else about that, and I'm wondering if that's correct or if it got vetoed somewhere along the line. Or
yeah, okay, Mary, what do you think?
I am not aware of anything to that effect.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm surprised they sent the card out. I mean, they're very reputable. It's not a fly-by-night place or anything.
Generally, it is what you donate before 12/31 of 2014 that is acceptable for your 14 return. One of the years when the tax bills were passed late in the year, they had some rules for sending money from your IRA, the $100,000 maximum, and they did extend that a little bit, but I'm not aware of anything with this that I've read, and I'm sure that if that had been the case and had been passed, we would have had a lot more discussion of it.
Yeah, you might want to, I'll bet on that postcard there was probably a website or something. I would contact them, shoot them an email and say, if this is not correct, and just let them know, because Judith is telling me the Association of Fundraising Professionals would be a good place to double check with too. But all the three of us are in agreement that it's not a good thing, or that at least that you can't do it. So you might want to go back and check with the institution. And thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Michelle in Wauwatosa. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I was just calling to comment on the fact that there are a lot of scammers out there posing as the IRS, and I was wondering if the guest could speak to that and inform the listeners exactly what the IRS would do if they were contacting you so that they don't fall for the scam.
And I know Mary wanted to talk about that, Michelle, so thanks for calling. Mary?
I think that's a wonderful topic. There are a lot of people in our world, we try not to know those people, but that do things that are not proper. The IRS generally does not call a person up, and the IRS does not generally send an unsolicited email. And both of these two things have been major scams that we've heard of. One of the TV talk shows, about a week ago even played a phone call from one of these scammers to people. And it was a very irritating, upsetting phone call. If the point with these people who are trying to contact people by email or by telephone and purporting to be the IRS is so that they can get bank account information, get personal information, social security numbers, the like. If the IRS is contacting you for some reason, they have a formality of sending letters. So at this point, they still use the post office. And so if someone got a phone call from the IRS, it would be after they have gotten a series of letters and, for instance, they were in a collection situation or an audit situation. And the people who are getting those should know that they're there. So anything that comes through unsolicited like that, hang up on them unless you want to get some information from them and turn that over to the IRS. At the IRS website, they do, if you type in identity theft, they have a place that you can report these things to the IRS, but they are painfully aware that these things are going on.
And Michelle, thanks for bringing that up. I really appreciate it. I wanted to give Scott a chance to join in from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Larry. I want to take you back to the earlier caller, Marilyn.
Yeah.
And I know somebody responded to that, I think maybe typed in, that she might want to contact the AARP. And I can tell you that in the La Crosse area here, the AARP is offering tax help for folks through the public library. So basically, all they need to do is either contact AARP or call the public library, and the central branch of the La Crosse Public Library, and they'll set up an appointment, and the AARP folks will, in fact, give them help with their taxes.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and I'm sure that ARP is probably doing that in other areas around the state as well, so it's good to know. And Bill in Beaver Dam, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Okay, an article in ARP magazine recently stated that, and I'll try to condense it down, that any distribution from a grandparent-owned 529 will count as untaxed student income the following year under the federal financial aid formula, and your student is receiving aid based on need, that income could shrink insistence. So they're saying that it's better for the parent to own the 529 than a grandparent to own the 529. What is her reaction?
Mary?
It's a good question, and I can't really address that question. That's more of the FAFSA area, and there is a discussion about what should be in the student's name, what should be in the parent's name, what should be in the grandparent's name. So I have to plead ignorance as far as knowing exactly how that goes into the financial aid formula.
Okay, there we go. We had an email from Gail in Milwaukee, a retired professional landscape designer, always worked for somebody else, so doesn't have a registered business. Sometimes people ask her to do work for them, but don't know how to report any of the income. We're talking less than $500 a year paid in cash. How is this any different from a 12-year-old mowing grass or someone babysitting? Is this reportable income?
The answer to that basically is any income that you receive for services that you have rendered is taxable income. It may be a business, it may be a hobby, but it is taxable income. Whether you get it in cash or not, that doesn't make any difference. So her $500 that she is getting for interior decorating or whatever the business that she mentioned is taxable income. If she is intending to make a profit on a personal return, it would be a Schedule C. If she is just doing it for fun, it may come into the hobby area, and she would report the income on line 21 as hobby income.
And in the end, if she hasn't made, there's a certain limit. Where
yes,
she,
if it is business income and it is over $400, there is self-employment tax that is due on it. If it is a hobby and it's truly a hobby, there is no self-employment tax on a hobby income. So it depends on intent of what's going on.
Sounds like it's more of a hobby for her because she's just doing it for friends for some, you know, and once in a while.
IRS
so.
Has some rules about what constitutes a business. And one of the conditions is it regular and continuous?
Ah, there we go. Mary Mellum, our guest, giving us some great information. She'll be with us right up till 12:30. Let's take a look at the news. If the thought that tax day is just 10 weeks away raises your stress level, I can guarantee you're not alone. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Every year there are small tweaks to the tax code. Sometimes, like this year, there are some big changes. All of them make a big difference, and that's why it's great to have Mary Mellum with us today. Mary's a tax professional from Green Bay, been in the tax business for a long time. She and her husband, Dave, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and I believe we have a link to her tax outfit on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. They serve about 1,200 accounting tax and accounting clients during the year, but they also consult other tax professionals as well. So tax professionals go to them for assistance. So you're getting some great advice from her, and I hope you'll join in if you have questions or comments about your taxes. And Mary Mario in Fond du Lac has a question for you, so let's go there. Mario, thank you for calling.
Oh, certainly. You're welcome. Larry, thank you for taking my call, and Mary, thank you for being a guest. Hey, before I get to my question, I also have a couple of ideas for Marilyn. One is, I believe that IRS themselves will do a tax return for you. I believe that you basically send your paperwork and tell them, I don't know how to do it, and they'll do it for you. The second one is, I had a relative that had a simple return, and it took him one time to H&R, and they did a free tax return.
Oh.
So some of the commercial people will do so. Anyway, my question goes back as a follow-up when Mary, at the beginning of the show. My question is, I have grandchildren out of state. If I contribute to their school program here, I forget the number, 529 or whatever it was. If I contribute to an out-of-state one, will Wisconsin allow me to take a credit or whatever? Can I get something from Wisconsin? And that basically is. I'm driving, so I'll take your answer on the I'll hang up and I'll listen to your answer, okay?
All right. Thanks, Mario. So, Mary, what do you think?
I'd like to address the IRS doing tax returns.
Yeah.
In the past, you could take your information to an IRS office, and they would help or do the tax return. Because of budget cuts, again, the IRS has stopped doing that.
Oh.
I don't know if you sent information to the IRS. I would be afraid to do that for fear of what would happen to it. So I think your VITA program, your ARP program, some other option like that is a better one than trying to do it through the IRS. I don't think you'll get very far.
Okay.
Then to the other question about the grandchildren out of state. If you are contributing to something other than an EdVest, or also Wisconsin has another program called Tomorrow's Scholar, which is an acceptable 529 plan. And those two programs are the only ones that you can contribute to that will allow you to have a deduction on the Wisconsin return. You certainly can contribute to other states' 529 plans, but there's no deduction associated with it.
Mm-hmm. Is there on your federal return?
There is no deduction on the federal return. The federal program is the 529 to allow tax-free growth of it when it's used for education.
Well, now, what about this? What if Mario put it in Wisconsin 529 for his out-of-state, or EDVES, let's say, for his out-of-state grandchildren? Would that work?
The answer, I believe, to that is yes. And here's why. At first, when the EdVest and Tomorrow Scholars programs were set up, they were supposed to be for education in-state. Just recently, there's a question and answer section that appears at the Department of Revenue or at the EdVest website, I think it is. And it says, the question is asked, do you need to go to a Wisconsin school to use this money? And the answer is no. So if the grandparents or if someone sets up an EdVest account and uses it for tuition at an acceptable school anywhere, it should be fine.
Ah, excellent. There you go, Mario. Thank you. Beth in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. My tax preparer made a mistake on taxes 2 years ago. I was audited. I had to pay $5,000 between federal and state in penalty and interest and tax return. Now, since I bought the peace of mind policy, the taxpayer is the one that had to pay that. Now they're saying that they have to issue me a 1099 miscellaneous, and I have to count that as income on taxes. Is that correct?
Boy, that doesn't sound fair, hardly, does it?
No, it didn't to me.
Well, here's the point. The peace of mind is an insurance. It's like an insurance policy that you get in case something happens. That money that you received is like getting an insurance payment, and that bill was paid for you, so it is taxable income. It's other income to you.
Okay.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. So if you had some damage to your house, let's say, in a windstorm or a hailstorm, and you got money from the insurance company to pay for it, would that be counted as income?
It would not be counted as income to the extent it replaced what you had.
Okay.
So if you get something more than the cost basis in what you have, something over and above that, you could have taxable income.
I gotcha.
What usually happens with insurance, though, or with the replacement in that case, as long as you reinvest it in the same idea, there is no taxable income to it. It's when you keep the money and don't buy the same a replacement property with insurance that causes you tax.
I got it. Okay, that makes sense. Lynn in Arborvitae, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My parent just, I'm the only child. My parent just passed away. And my bookkeeper's telling me that I have to pay like 40% of my inheritance to taxes. And I always thought it was if you had like over $3 million or over $2 million. Because this money's already been taxed. I mean, when she bought stocks and annuities and property, she paid with that money that she earned, and she'd already paid taxes on that money. So what is my responsibility for taxes on what I'm going to inherit?
Mary?
Well, okay. Inheritance is a confusing thing, and the 40% is the current rate of tax on a 706 form, and that is the form that is counting all the value of the person who died. When a person mm-hmm. dies, an estate is created, and the value of all the property they own at the minute after they die is added all up. And you are right in saying that there is a dollar amount. It is roughly $5 million. It's been indexed for inflation. But it's basically, using a round number, $5 million. If at the time the person dies, their assets, the value of their assets, are greater than $5 million, the excess over that would be a taxable event at 40%. Now, there are some other things. I'm giving you a simplified version of that. There's some things that during the lifetime, like gifts, that might have been involved in that. But that's not your side. That would be the estate's problem. You, as the only child, may be the personal representative and have to, if there were income in excess of that, have to pay that out of the estate's assets. But when it comes to you and you inherit the items, generally those items are not taxable to you. For instance, if you inherit a house, you inherit that property, you don't have income from that inheritance, and you have a cost basis in that equal to what the fair market value of that property is. However, there are certain things that could be taxable to you. If parents had annuities or if they had retirement programs, IRAs, that money may never have been taxed, and when you receive it, you would have to pay taxes on it because that type of income is what we call income in respect of a decedent, and it would not get a step up in basis.
But would it be at the 40% tax?
No.
This,
the 40% is the inheritance tax rate. There's two different things going on. The 40% is inheritance tax, and it is an excise or a valuation tax. It's not an income tax. It's a separate kind of tax.
I know, but this is way under $5 million.
And that's fine.
So,
and that's, if it's under $5 million, there may be no inheritance tax. That's the 40% tax. But if you inherit something that is other than a tangible thing, like stock or like bonds maybe or property, if you inherit something like retirement programs, annuities, IRAs, pension programs, you may have to pay income tax at your own income tax level on that money.
And your income tax level is not going to be 40%.
I think it's at 30 already.
Yeah, well, maybe it'll go.
Ours is already at 30. That's why I thought that there was that $5 million or whatever was not taxed 40% until after that was over that amount.
There's two different things.
Yeah.
That's inheritance tax. Income tax is a separate issue.
Yep, there you go. So you're okay on the inheritance tax side if you're under $5 million, but there's probably income tax ramifications. Is that correct, Mary?
There could be income tax ramifications depending on what it is you inherited.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And, you know, if you're not happy with how your one tax preparer was talking, you might seek out another one and get another piece of advice as well that might go along with more in the vein of what Mary was talking about. And thanks, Lynn. Dan in Door County, your turn. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I started a organic vegetable garden, and I'm wondering how many years you can take a loss on farming before you're considered not a for-profit, you're just a hobby. And can you take a break 1 year and then go back to it?
That's a very good question. The IRS does look at hobby income versus business income. And there is a law that basically says that the IRS has a presumption of a business if you have to make a profit in at least 2 out of 5 years. However, they look at more factors than that to determine between a business and a hobby. And many times, people who are farmers have losses every year. They look at more than that. They look at what you're doing in it, how much time and effort you put into it, how much of an investment you are, how the business is carried on. What they are trying to avoid is someone using a business to create a loss to offset other income. So even though there's a 2 out of 5 year presumption of a business, there are more factors that go into it to determine whether a loss will be allowed for more years than that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you could go 5 years before you'd even get questioned on it, it sounds like.
It's possible. Again, if you are questioned, what they're going to look for is, do you have something like a business plan? Do you have a realization of making a profit? Are things getting better? Do you have other income that you're trying to offset and stop paying taxes on as a result of creating this loss?
No, that hasn't been the case. So.
Okay. So you're probably safe, Dan. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Todd from Cross Plains has a question. Hi, Todd.
Hello. My question kind of follows the last caller. I had a small business that is now defunct. All the money came through to me. I was carrying a loss that I was going to carry over on this year's taxes, but I was wondering, depreciation and such, but I was wondering, since the business is defunct, can I carry that over onto my personal income tax for this year?
Okay. If you have depreciable assets that you are no longer using in a business, the depreciation that's calculated with that would not be allowed. You still have that business asset. If you were to dispose of that asset and you had a loss as a result of disposing of it, you'd be allowed that loss. If you're not operating a business, generally you're not going to have losses. However, if you were in business and there are leftover payments that you have to make related to something that happened in that business, you still could take those losses on your Schedule C even after the business has gone under, if they are related to that business, like, you know, it could be suppliers that you had to pay or bills that came after the fact that were related to that business.
Got it.
Okay.
All right, Todd.
Good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And John in West Allis. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Larry. Thank you for having this wonderful speaker on. I have always been struggling with how the capital gains tax works. It's different. Capital gains rate is different for those in the two lower tax brackets than those in the higher tax brackets. And I guess the scenario that I think of is, what if somebody has a large amount of capital gains, $100,000 or more, certainly putting him well beyond the 15% tax bracket, but his income is in the 10% tax bracket? How is his capital gains actually calculated? If I believe right, it is a 0% capital gains in the first two tax brackets for this year yet?
The answer to that is yes, and that's a permanent change.
Oh, good. Good. So if I'm in a 10% tax bracket, or somebody I know is in a 10% tax bracket, they're retired, they're living off of a means, but they have a large capital gains. They bought GE stock, you know, way back in the 50s, and they have a huge capital gain available to them. So they liquidate the stock, and they have this $100,000 worth of capital gains. Do they pay no taxes on that?
That's not exactly how it works, but let me try to explain.
How should it be calculated?
It's kind of a sliding. It's a sliding scale. The top capital gain rate is 20%. That only happens to people who are roughly in the $400,000 range.
Okay.
The other tax bracket is a 15% tax bracket, and it affects people who are in above 15 and above 15%. And then there is the 0% tax bracket that is for people who are in the 10 and the 15% bracket. But the way the form works or the calculation works, if, for example, someone had $100,000 of capital gain and only enough regular income that put them in the 10% bracket, the amount of the income that it would take to get them to the end of the 15% tax bracket would still get that zero capital gain benefit for that much of the income. And then the additional income beyond that would be taxed at the 15% rate, assuming they don't get up to the 20% rate.
Okay. Yeah, that makes
sense. One thing, if you want no capital gain, you have to keep your income under the 15% tax bracket, which might mean selling off part of it this year and then selling off another part the next year. If you take the full lump, chances are you're going to fall into the next bracket and pay higher on that much of the income.
So what one person could do is look at his table that say if you're married, your 15% tax bracket goes up to like $78,000 and so forth. So what you're saying then is that the capital gain would be recorded or used as ordinary income to fill up that 15% tax bracket, somewhere around $78,000. And then after that, anything left...
You're going to get the 0% rate up to income that touches the end of the 15% tax bracket. Hmm.
Okay.
So if you're not using it all on ordinary income and you have long-term capital gain, because it has to be long-term, and you can use so much of that $100,000 in your example that gets you to the end of the 15% bracket, and you will get the 0% on that much of it. And then the additional part that's left over will be taxed at the higher rate.
There you go. Good luck, John. Thank you so much for calling. Had a Facebook question from Mary who wondered who would like to write off out-of-pocket expenses for medical costs from 2014, such as deductibles and the 20% copay. Can she do that?
There's two steps to the medical issues. Medical deductions are Schedule A itemized deductions. First of all, you have to be able to itemize. Secondly, and itemized deductions for a married couple, for a single person, your standard deduction is $6,200. You have to have itemized deductions that qualify over the $6,200 in order to get you any extra benefit. If that is the case, medical deductions have another separate phase or another separate floor before you get to how much medical you can deduct. Currently, that is 10% for most people, unless you're over the age of 65 or married to someone who is 65 or older. Then it still is at the 7.5%. So if someone has medical deductions and they have a $20,000 income, that $20,000, 10% of that is $2,000. Their medical deduction is only the amount over that $2,000.
Ah, there we go.
So it's a combination thing.
Mary, you are a joy to have on the show. You know a lot, and you do a wonderful job explaining, and I thank you so much. I hope we can do this again.
Well, I have enjoyed it as well, Larry.
Thank you so much. Mary Mellum, tax professional, operates Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals in Green Bay with her husband David, and does just a fantastic job talking about your taxes and mine, for that matter. And great to have her along, and we certainly will try to get her back. Garden Talk coming up tomorrow, and the author of The Market Gardener will be our guest. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.